Good evening and welcome to one of the final sessions in the Hub. I'm really thrilled that you've taken time out at this stage in the festival to come and be part of what's going on here in the literature programme. My name's Ben Whitehouse. Sorry, I keep forgetting to introduce myself. My name's Ben Whitehouse and I'm one of the literature coordinators for the festival, and you're going to meet the other one in a second. Catherine Venn is right behind me and she's just smiling at me. Catherine studied for a master's in creative writing at UEA in 2009 and then returned to London to continue working part-time as commissioning editor. Her bio says that she's currently redrafting her first novel, which she hasn't told me anything about, which I think is just remiss. And a nice fact for you about Catherine: despite moving around London more times than almost anyone she knows, she's always lived on the same two pages of the A to Z. So, ladies and gentlemen, please make Catherine Venn feel very, very welcome.
Thank you. What a lovely welcome. It's nice to be clapped before you've even said anything. So thank you. I'm really conscious that it's 7 o'clock on Monday evening and everything's beginning to draw to a close. We're beginning to think about going home. It's been an amazing weekend, hasn't it? I've been really busy, but it's been fantastic. But we're all probably looking forward now to heading home at some point, sleeping in our own beds, washing. I know I certainly need to do that. So I kind of want to pay attention to that, pay attention to this space that we're in, where we're kind of between things. I want to invite you to think about what it is that you're on the way home to. Of course, Greenbelt and everything that it represents and a lot of the people who are here are actually a kind of home to many of us, certainly to me. So I think there's a tension here between homes, temporary homes, and the things that we long for. And that's really the main thrust of what I want to talk about tonight, some of the tensions surrounding home. I remember my first ever Greenbelt when I was about 9 or 10. I've tried to establish when it was that I first came, but neither I nor my parents can actually remember the first year we came together as a family. But festivals are really, really special when you're a kid, aren't they? Staying up late, being exposed to all this exciting new stuff, exotic things and people, the camping. And there's something uniquely exciting about it, I think, the first time you come as a child. But one of my clearest memories of that first year was around halfway through, when I kind of bounded up to my dad and said that I couldn't wait to come again the following year. And of course, his very sensible response was, why are you waiting for next year? You're in it right now. Just enjoy this year, which, of course, is a very good point. But looking back on it, I think that what I said was in part an expression of childish excitement and exuberance, but also perhaps saying something a bit deeper about myself and maybe about many of us, that so often, even when we're in the middle of something fun and new and exciting, we can feel disconnected and we can long for something else, something around the corner or in the future or just off in the distance a little bit. Last year, as Ben said, I did a creative writing master's course, and as part of that, I did a fiction module. I was mainly doing poetry, but I took a bit of fiction on the side. And the very first thing that our tutor asked us to think about was what he called our psychic creative territory. And what he meant by that was the bit that you can't really be taught as a writer. It's that bit of you where the impulse to write actually comes from. And for me, I immediately knew that ideas of home, ideas of escape, but also more deeply of finding somewhere to belong, and the tension between those two things, escape and belonging, probably constitute for me the main sort of imaginative wellspring of my writing. It's a sort of longing or wistfulness, or sometimes a beautiful kind of melancholy that you feel towards the world, something lost or maybe not yet found. And I think it's something that I've always felt, despite being incredibly privileged to come from a very secure and loving home. As Ben mentioned, I'm currently redrafting a children's novel. And simply put, that could be described as two characters journeying for somewhere that they can call home. But I'd say that in a more abstract way, my poetry too is, which I'm going to be reading from as part of this talk, is really deeply concerned with ideas of home, with a yearning for connection with the world or with beauty, with something that was lost once. And that's what I want to talk about this evening, as we're in this wonderful place, but we're also thinking about heading home tomorrow, or maybe later on tonight, to talk around this longing for home and pull out a few of the paradoxes that surround it. And I want to allow a little bit of space as well for us to think about what home means to us. So I'd like you to just reflect now on this. What are your dreams of home? What is it that you're longing for? This is a poem called In Reverse. Sometimes there's this dreamlike pull to stand and stare into the mirror, look past its bright, flat surface into the room beyond. A place where sunlight slants in quite a different way onto that chair, which faces now the opposite direction. The pile of books looks weightier, neatly stacked just so on shelves that hold a quiet perfection which this side doesn't. The desk is more inviting somehow in that corner, not this. The reflection suddenly so beguiling you wonder if life would lighten if you could step into that other room where objects seem more true. Even your writing, hold it up, see how back to front it blooms, looks as though it has some different sound, which your actual words, hard scrabble, full of gloom, know nothing of. Or on the underground, through the half-open window at the end, you see the carriage in front, curving round, and imagine in its graceful bend how your mirror self would likely step through those doors, not these, and how it might lend a certain poise, a quite different shape, to the life you actually lead, how it would be lipsticked, serious, crowded round with hopes you carry in this seat, and how she, unlike you, wouldn't know the special sadness of evenings as the sky turns its deep, coppered blue, when all at once you're caught by the longing for something you think you knew once or felt, a dream that dissolved in the moment of waking, and though what it is escapes you, it has you held. The sense of having lost something, of being fundamentally alienated from your own self, from life, from others, the longing for something you think you knew once or felt, where does this come from? The Bible, of course, suggests that we lost something in the fall. However we want to interpret Genesis 3, literally or mythologically or whatever, we all know, don't we, that at some stage something went horribly wrong for us as humans, for us here on this earth. We long for justice and for rightness, and yet so often we find we are fundamentally unable to do justice, to act rightly. This all points, I think, to something in us being broken, or at the very least, unbearably fragile. Genesis tells us that the story of humanity begins with a home in a garden, but very soon turns into a story of homelessness. Adam and Eve are banished from their home, and an angel with a fiery sword prevents them from returning to it. And of course, what they lost was not just their home, but their being at home with God, his presence, his companionship. And this is now where we all live, isn't it? East of Eden. But it doesn't stop there. The Old Testament is full of stories of people being made homeless. Cain kills his brother and becomes a fugitive. Abraham is a wanderer, and the only land he ever owns is a burial plot, and there's something incredibly poignant about that, isn't there? His descendants end up slaves in Egypt, and when they're finally set free, they spend 40 years in the desert, all the time longing for that promised land. When they finally get there, they really only have a few hundred years, don't they, of relative peace before being uprooted and exiled. So I wonder if we can see the Bible itself as a story of people dreaming of home, of setting out to be restored to a home that was lost once. The next poem that I'd like to read to you, I wrote at a time when I didn't really know who I was or what I was journeying towards anymore. I certainly knew that all the old maps of evangelical certainty didn't work for me anymore, but still I was compelled by this pull towards God in some way, towards home. And this poem was inspired by two things in particular. The two lines from a Cavafy poem, which I've taken as the title of my talk, which I'll read some of later, and then something that I overheard in a bookshop once. If anyone's ever visited the big Blackwell's bookshop in Oxford, you'll know that they have an enormous cavern downstairs that's absolutely full of books called the Norrington Room. And I was down there browsing with my aunt once around Christmas time. And I had those Cavafy lines, as you set out for Ithaca, hope your voyage is a long one. I had those lines going around my head, and I was thinking about wanting to write a poem for the new year and a poem that would somehow reflect this strange space that I was in. And suddenly we heard this rather distinctive voice say, "All the maps of Russia stop at Moscow." And we were really struck, both of us, by those words. They seemed so evocative, so suggestive. And the voice, we were sure we recognised it. So we stuck our heads around the end of the book stack. And there was Terry Waite, who was, of course, the envoy for the Church of England, who was held captive in Lebanon for, I think, 4 years, striding along with a rather harried-looking bookshop assistant in his wake. So he was clearly on the way to Russia, and he was clearly going somewhere beyond Moscow. And I just thought this was an incredibly fantastic picture, someone who was kept from home for such a long time but still travelling to places that don't appear to have readily available maps, well, not in England anyway. So those words somehow got caught up in my static, and they combined with the Cavafy poem and the sense that I had at the time that I needed to find a new way of following after God, and this is the poem that I wrote. All the maps of Russia stop at Moscow. But home lies somewhere beyond, under the blue bowl of sky, ceramic, unglazed. I've heard tell of vast forests, immense fields, black soil. But there are no maps, and my only clue is a mustard seed wrapped in cabbage leaf complexities of skin and heart. I must make my own way, collect to myself the riches I hope to find. A pine cone, a tug of sheep's wool, a smooth pebble, a papery seed case, a seashell. I am a riffle in a stream, catching particles of gold, of light. And if there is, after all, a home to be found, I need to see the shining thread, to feel its pull. So the first paradox that I think we're faced with as we're thinking about journeys home is one that's embodied in the poem Ithaca, which, as I said, I've taken as the title for my talk, by the Greek poet Cavafy. So in case you don't know, Ithaca was the island of Odysseus, who was a Greek hero who, after fighting in the Trojan War for 10 years, offended the gods and had to spend another 10 years getting back home. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's quite a long poem, but here are a few lines from it. Ithaca. As you set out for Ithaca, hope the voyage is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. Keep Ithaca always in your mind. Arriving there is what you're destined for. But don't hurry the journey at all. Better if it lasts for years. So you're old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you've gained on the way, not expecting Ithaca to make you rich. Ithaca gave you the marvellous journey. Without her, you wouldn't have set out. She has nothing left to give you now. So what I think we need to hold in tension is this. We've set out for somewhere, for home, and yet we're encouraged to hope that the voyage is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. But what does this mean, and why would we ever want the journey to be a long one? I think it's a paradox that's actually suggested to us by the Bible. I've said that perhaps the overarching story of the Bible could be seen as a journey from a lost home to a new one, that what Jesus did for us is to set us on the road home to the Father. But when we look at ideas of home, in the Old Testament particularly, there seems to be quite a lot of ambiguity around the whole thing. There are all these promises of home that are made, but how many of them are actually straightforwardly fulfilled? Abraham was promised that he would be made into a great nation, but he never saw that himself. and his life was characterised by moving from one place to the next. Even more, the Israelites were promised their own land, but spent a protracted and painful time in the desert trying to get there. The promised land is something that is just that, promised, given, but it also seems to be something that is long delayed, something that we need to seek after and search for in difficulty. It's as though God is calling his people to something but never quite allowing them to settle. So I wonder, does God perhaps prefer wanderers and travellers and pilgrims? In his often provocative book about the spiritual discipline of pilgrimage, The Sacred Journey, the author Charles Foster suggests this. I'm going to quote from it. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, Yahweh is loudly and unequivocally on the side of the nomads. He was a pilgrim god, travelling in a box slung over the shoulders of refugees and worshipped in a tent. His preference for the nomads is understandable. Yahweh, whenever and in whatever guise he appeared, was a traveller. There are things about the nomad's life that embody Yahweh's values and character. Life on the edges, indiscriminate and costly hospitality, solidarity with the marginalised, intimate relationships with humans and the environment, a new view at every step, the loosest possible hold on possessions. And then even when they do settle down, God seems to want to remind his people constantly that they're gypsy stock, essentially. And Deuteronomy 26 has God saying this to his people: when you've come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess, and you possess it and settle in it, you shall make this response before the Lord your God: a wandering Aramean was my ancestor. Isn't that, I just find that so resonant somehow. They're not allowed to forget where they've come from. They've come from a line of wanderers. So it seems to me that God is a fan of the old cliche: it's not the destination that counts, or maybe it's not just the destination, it's the journey. Is this because in some way it's actually the journey that shapes us for the home that we're destined for? As in the Cavafy poem, we become wealthy with all we've gained on the way, or in my poem, we collect to ourselves the riches that we hope to find. And of course, the really striking thing is that not only does God invite us onto this journey, but he walks it with us. In some mysterious way, he submits to being carried around in a box by his people. His home with them is a movable tent, if a grand one. And so we wander towards a home that God has called us to, that he's promised us, with that very same God. He's on the road with us. This next poem is another one that I wrote for the new year. It's called Plough Monday, which is the traditional agricultural name for the first Monday after Twelfth Night, when labourers would go back to work after all the Christmas celebrations were over. So it's a poem, I hope, for those times when we're back in the field, we're back on the road, and the going is tough. And just to explain a small detail, traditionally, a young ox would be yoked to an older one, which would set the pace and help the younger one learn how to pull the plough. Plough Monday, and celebration set aside again, gives way to steady head down stamp and sigh of turning up the earth, the year's field curving to meet a blank page of sky. The broken soil clogs, then numbs, cold like steel. But remember this as you walk the loam: you're hitched to an older beast, who knows his work. Yield to his pace as he pulls the plough to its mark. Home. I think that Jesus, in the end, has to be central to our understanding of home. And so another paradox that I think we need to hold on to is the way that Jesus was at home in the world, and also the way that he wasn't fundamentally at home in the world. On some deep level, he left his home. He made himself nothing, as Philippians has it, to make his home with us. And then there's the beginning of John's Gospel, where John says that Jesus being made a man was in some sense a homecoming, but rather a doubtful one. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And so Jesus' own experience of home, of coming home, the incarnation, was disappointing and ambiguous and shadowy. He was both received and he also went unrecognised. And of course we see this particularly painfully when Jesus is rejected at Nazareth. Only in his hometown, among his relatives and in his own house, is a prophet without honour, he says. And this didn't just mean Nazareth, of course, did it? The parable of the tenants who kill the vineyard owner's son is an indictment of the whole of Israel. Jesus came to what should have been his home, but rather than being welcomed, he ended up dead. All this is, of course, on the macro level. But if we zoom in on the micro, actually all the smaller details of Jesus' life paint a picture of homelessness too. He was born in a borrowed room, laid in a makeshift cradle. He too was exiled to Egypt. And the Gospels are full of accounts of him staying with other people, moving from place to place as an itinerant preacher and teacher. He doesn't appear to have had his own home, or if he did, he left it when he began his public ministry, and he never had a family. Even his tomb was borrowed, and somehow I kind of connect that with Abraham in some strange way and find that very moving. As he himself said so poignantly, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." So what does this mean to those of us who long for home, a future home, or in fact, any kind of home at all? I think it shows us once again that we belong to a God who submits to being homeless with us, a God who comes to us and walks with us, a God who's on our side. It means we follow a journeying God who is himself never settled. This is a quote from Charles Foster's book again. "When Yahweh became a man, he was a homeless vagrant. He walked through Palestine proclaiming that a mysterious kingdom had arrived. That was and is the gospel. He called people to follow him, and that meant walking. The kingdom that sprang up around his dusty feet was weird. It was a place in which the first were last and the last were first. This Yahweh man, partly because he was an itinerant tramp and partly because that's the way the kingdom always works, particularly fascinated the people on the edges of things, the underdogs, the despised. He wasn't a big hit with the urban establishment." But then held in tension with this set of tensions is the fact that Jesus promises us that we do, in fact, have a home, an ultimate place of belonging and care and hospitality and all those good, beautiful things that we long for. I love Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of John 14 in The Message. "You trust God, don't you? Trust me. There's plenty of room for you in my Father's home. If that weren't so, would I have told you that I'm on my way to get a room ready for you? And if I'm on my way to get your room ready, I'll come back and get you so you can live where I live. And you already know the road I'm taking." This next poem isn't about home so much, but it is about Jesus and about some of the paradoxes that he holds together in his person. The Bible's full of metaphors for who Jesus is and what his kingdom work is about. And I took 24 of those images from both the Old and New Testaments, which are in some way opposing sets, you know, the seed and the sower, the yeast and the bread, the lion and the lamb. And I wrote this. 12 promises. 1. Unsayable first word written into the text of everything. Or the author of that word, crafting subtle subplots, each one a fractal of the story's whole. 2. The roundness of a seed wrapped small, its promise mapped in minute detail. Or the patience of the one who works the frozen field, tends it even as I sleep. 3. A gate hung in a dry stone wall, its lopsided grin an invitation to vault to the other side. Or the other side itself, the path leading on and down, scramble of pebbles, tough ground beneath my feet. 4. A rock rooted in the land, unmoving, your own solitary self. Or the shadow of a rock, cool corridors of stone I used to play in. 5. A lover's hands that touch a cheek or smooth the knots out from my hair. Or are they doctor's hands, wounded, skillful, gentle on a bandaged heart? 6. A woman working yeast into the dough to do its hidden work, an alchemy of rising. Or the loaf of bread, dense and chewy in my mouth. 7. A stubborn stump of tree that wakes to send up shoots at the scent of water. Or the branch that grows from it, sinewy and strong. 8. Child, gift long looked for, the answer to a life spent waiting. Or a teacher who cuts through easy answers with wily questions of his own. 9. Fresh hatched lamb trembling on its newfound legs. Or the one who roars, who knows his foe and will not let him go. 10. A fountain in a city square, flinging itself to the sky, each drop exulting in its climb and fall. Or the dense grey slab of laundry soap, sudsing up the water's play. 11. Venus, who rises from the deep well of night, tugging the morning after her. Or the dawn itself filling the bowl of sky above my head with light. 12. Beginning, source, first word, the way a spring gathers water, swells, flows. Or the end, the place where the river gives itself, surrenders to the sea. Of course, the danger of seeing ourselves as on a journey to somewhere beyond, with this longing in our hearts for another world, another home, is that we can see ourselves as just pilgrims passing through, and we can overemphasize in our theology a life after death rather than living the life before death that Jesus has called us to. Eternal life begins here and now, and so we need to keep in tension the already of the kingdom alongside the not yet. So God calls us to be at home here, as well as to keep journeying. It's another paradox, but I think it's vital that we do keep that tension. And this can be a painful message, can't it, when the homes that we find ourselves in are not comfortable, are themselves places of disappointment, or homesickness, or broken dreams, as they were for the Israelite exiles in Babylon. But this is the message, settle down, because you're going to be there for a while, that God told Jeremiah to write to those exiles. We often skip over the beginning of that letter, don't we, in our rush to get to the lovely promise of Jeremiah 29:11, the plans I have for you. But it's right there at the beginning of the letter, and I think we need to pay attention to it. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. I can only imagine that this must have been an extremely difficult message to hear, particularly when there were apparently so many other people on the scene saying the precise opposite, that the Israelites would be coming home soon. And 70 years is a long time to wait to go home. Can we reflect on where we don't feel at home? Where do you feel most uncomfortable at the moment? Are there parts of your life where you feel in exile? And in that place or those places, is there a way that you can somehow turn things around so that you're opening that place up to other people and allowing other people to feel at home in that place where you yourself can't be at home? The fact is, this, where we live, is our home. And as broken as it is, the here and now is where we belong. And God calls us to be faithful to the world, to be salt and light in it, to seek its peace and its prosperity, and not just for our own benefit, but for those around us. And of course, the majority of Jesus' message to us does not concern itself with the eternal hereafter, but with the here and now. And he insists that where we are, this earth now, is a good place to be, because ultimately it's God's house. I love the way Dallas Willard, who's a philosopher and theologian, talks about this. In his book, The Divine Conspiracy, he writes this: Jesus brings the assurance that our universe is a perfectly safe place for us to be. The very heart of his message, as well as of his personality and actions, is found in such well-known words as these from Matthew 6. My advice would be not to worry about what is going to happen to you, about what you will have to eat or drink, or about what clothes you will wear. Your life doesn't consist of eating, and there is much more to your body than clothing. Take a lesson from the birds of heaven. They don't sow or reap or hoard away in granaries, and your Father, the one in the heavens around you, sees to it that they have food. Aren't you more important than birds? Somehow the world is a perfectly safe place for us to be, even when all around us things are going wrong. This next poem captures, I hope, some of the sense that even in the middle of the chaos and the overwhelming disappointment that we can sometimes face, there is blessing and this is home. I wanted to write something about that thing that is, for me, probably the closest that I get to a sense of physical blessing, which is when you can feel the sun on your skin. You know what I mean, don't you? That real sense of well-being that you get when you've got the sun on your face, which unfortunately we haven't had too much of this weekend, or in fact this summer. It's also a poem about the places we call home. So, in the house where I and my sisters did some of our growing up, we had this sofa that was positioned in front of some French doors that opened out onto the garden. And behind the sofa, there was this kind of this piece of carpet that was really special, because it was a hiding place, because you could lie down behind the sofa. And if anyone else walked into the room, they couldn't immediately see that you were there. So it sort of felt hidden, but actually it was a public open space. So it was open, but it felt secret, and I wonder if that's maybe the best kind of home. So in the afternoons, you'd get the sun coming through the French windows, and sometimes one or more of us would just lie down on the carpet and just doze in the sun. So this poem is about that experience with my sisters, and it's called Blessing. All afternoon, we've lain here on the floor, just on the edge of sleep, splayed out on that strange betweenland piece of carpet that stretches from behind the sofa to the garden door. A secret kind of place, just by virtue of being slightly out of sight, but open and double bed spacious for the three of us to lie on, faces slightly crumpled into carpet. And the dog flopping down to join us, then getting up and coming back again. The sunlight makes the dust motes twirl and swoon, a spell that holds us here, heavy-lidded, for an hour or more, our murmured shifting following the light as it slowly travels the room. And for that hour, it seems as though this is what it means to be in the moment, as though you could stop the kitchen clock and say, look, this is what it is to be awake, even as we doze. This pause, this parenthesis that brackets three sisters in our dreams, the sun's touch, a warm hand on our faces. So what is it that we're called to, and where is our ultimate home? The Alternative Service Book has this lovely prayer in it, which I've always thought very beautiful. Father of all, we give you thanks and praise that when we were still far off, you met us in your Son and brought us home. The biblical narrative suggests, I think, that our lost home is the lost presence of God, and so our new home, our ultimate home, is restored companionship with him. And we already see that in part, don't we? But one day we'll see it in full. I love the Psalms for the way they describe God as being our true home. Psalm 90 says that God is our dwelling place throughout all generations. And Psalm 84 gives us a beautiful picture of the kind of home that God offers to us, to all people. Even the sparrow has found a home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar, Lord Almighty, my King and my God. Blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you. I love this, that somehow in God we find ourselves at home along with all the things that are at home in us that we contain. There's a space and a safety for everyone, the smallness of sparrows and the frivolity of swallows. So I wonder, where do you most feel at home? And is it a place that you can invite God into? Or maybe is God already there? And then, of course, in his revelation, John gives us a picture of what the ultimate fulfillment of all our longings for home will be. Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. This is a poem about a dream I once had. I suppose it's about lost things and the hope of their future restoration, and the work that we're called to now to help that future come to be. The garden. Last night I dreamt I walked the garden that my parents planted. It was just as I remembered it, and more than it had ever been. Its pond bright with the flash of fish, roses climbing on a sunny wall, the old tumble-down greenhouse restored with all its pipes and tricks. The words surfaced slowly, or perhaps someone whispered in my ear. They tended their acre. It is for you only to till and keep your own plot here. And down the avenue of the years, look to walk your garden in the evening breeze. So our final happy homecoming will be to find ourselves at last in God's presence. But the deeply strange and mysterious thing is that actually, even on our journey towards him, God has already made his home in us. So with the coming of the Holy Spirit, it's no longer us who have to go on pilgrimage to find God. It's he who somehow travelled to us and made his home in us. For me, this is probably the most mysterious part of faith, that we are God's home. And it's held in tension with our longing to find our way back home, that God too longs to find his way back home to us. We now are the tabernacle, are the temple, us in our bodies, these hands and faces and eyes and legs and feet, each one of us individually and all of us together as a body, the church. We are now God's dwelling place. It's so easy to say these words, but they're so revolutionary, so upside down, so radical. They change everything. I used to read that that passage in 1 Corinthians, "Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you've received from God?" I used to read those words with a sort of dread and guilt, because of course the context is that Paul's talking about sex. But I've come to understand that these words are not just of dire warning, or maybe not at all, but rather the offer of God's humbling himself to be at home with us. The Spirit is promised to us as our companion. The word literally means to eat with us. And what a beautiful image that is of sitting down to eat with God. And so heaven, which is a word that I've avoided using in this talk so far, is after all not something up there, it's down here. Home is closer in the end than we all think. It's here, now. I love what Eugene Peterson writes about it. Heaven, in Gospels and the Apocalypse and throughout Scriptures, is the metaphor that tells us that there is far more here than meets the eye. Beyond and through what we see, there is that which we cannot see, and which is, wondrously, not out there, but right here before us and among us. God, his rule, his love, his judgment, his salvation, his mercy, his grace, his healing, his wisdom. Calling the word heaven a metaphor does not make it less real. It simply recognises that it is a reality inaccessible at this point to any of our five senses. I'd like to end with a poem that I see as being somehow a counterpart or sequel, if poems can be said to have sequels, to one of the poems that I read earlier, "All the Maps of Russia Stop at Moscow." It's called "The Road Home," and it was inspired by this quote about St. Brendan the Navigator, who was one of the early Irish monastic saints. After 7 years of travelling, St. Brendan reached the Promised Land at the end of the world. There he met a youth who explained to him why it took so long. "You could not find it immediately because God wanted to show you his varied secrets in the great ocean." Isn't that beautiful? The intimacy of God having secrets that he wants to share with us. The road home. "You couldn't find it straight away, as first," he said, "he had to show you something. The treasures of darkness. The varied secrets of the earth for you to roll around your mouth like sweets." A cliche, but it's all about the journey, not the destination, right? "But still you think it would be good to arrive one day. Lie down on the world's soft pillow. Sleep." So you walked until in one sleight of hand trick he rolled it up for you to see you'd been walking all this time the contours of your own heart. An antique map like vellum, all suede softness and crimson ribbons. And those whispers in your ear, not clues to some vague out there, but in here. Not out there, but in here. We travel hopefully towards a home that is God's presence, and along the way we travel with a God who is strangely already present with and in us. That's your lot.
Steady now, don't encourage her. Catherine's kindly agreed to do take some time for Q&A, and also she's written a poem as a blessing, which we'll have right at the end of our time together. So if you want to ask anything, questions, comments.
Nothing
on almost anything, I think. Catherine's agreed. So if you want to just raise your hand, wave at me. Oh, okay.
One thing I noticed, one thing I noticed with your poems, there was a repeated theme and motif of circularity, not just in the sense of journeys, from the smallest journey like the one with the dog, settling down, getting up, walking about and then coming back again, to the ox ploughing the field and the circularity of the seasons and the year that that implied, but it's almost circular motifs as in objects, like the seed within the cabbage leaves and Venus rising in the sky and the sun as well. I mean, all those various circularities, were they all intentional or were some of them almost unintentional?
That's really interesting. And actually, I hadn't really noticed that in my own work before, so that tells you something, doesn't it? I'm kind of fascinated by roundness. I know that sounds a bit weird, but there is something about nests and about seeds and about circles and enclosed places that has always kind of fascinated me.
Do you think maybe it's something that even goes back to the womb and that sort of circularity that encloses us whilst we're growing inside and before we emerge at the beginning of life?
Yeah, I suppose an understanding that I've kind of come to recently in terms of my own way of where I fit into the world is understanding that this is all, in some deep sense, God's house, and we do all exist within it. I suppose I've moved from a theology that sees God as being very kind of distant and up there and in heaven, as we're all enclosed within it somehow. I'm not sure I've got anything kind of interesting to say in response to that, but I'll have a think about it, because it is a really interesting motif, you're right. I suppose it's about the small and the natural and the being enclosed and, as you say, probably the womb-like as well. But I'll think on that further, thank you. Can just go now if no one's got any questions. Quite happy to go to the pub.
Stop the bargaining.
I'm loving this, Catherine. This is beautiful. But
thank you.
In there is a, I don't know, it just, as well as house, there was a sense of absence. Maybe it's just me where I'm at, but the sense of, it felt like there was a home, but yet God was not there.
Yeah, well, I think this is maybe, what I mentioned at the beginning of somehow always, even as a child, had this, and coming from a very happy home, actually, always having this kind of yearning for home. But I did have a home, so what was I actually looking for? And I think that's always been a part of my spirituality as well as a part of my kind of aesthetic way of understanding the world. In terms of absence, I mean, maybe again that relates to what I was saying before about having moved from a theology that might see this as being like a house that God built and then just kind of, went off and left us to it. But I hope I'm not still in that place. I hope I'm in a place, where I understand the world as God's home and he's in it with us. But then there is always this longing, isn't there? And there is always this sense of brokenness and our own fragility and our own frailty and not even living up to our own expectations, let alone anyone else's. So maybe that's where the absence comes from. I mean, I'm a poet. I'm meant to be depressed, right? She says with a smile on her face.
Hi, Catherine. I thought that was fantastic.
Thank you.
The journey that you describe in some ways sounds quite solitary. How important is it that it isn't just the individual and God or a sense of God, but the individual and neighbour, as it were?
I think it's really important. I guess that's not something that I've brought out in this at all, but I suppose I could have dwelt on the New Testament and how ideas of home in the New Testament are kind of reconfigured so that the household becomes the central focus of faith, doesn't it? And that's how the church started, in people's households. And there is a lot in the New Testament, isn't there, about we are now God's household. It's not just metaphors of the body, but it's the house as well. So that was something that I kind of thought about as I was preparing, but couldn't fit the whole lot in. But you're absolutely right. I think writing is quite solitary, and that's kind of, you know, that was the root of approach for me in preparing this talk. So it was always going to be a slightly solitary road, and certainly, writing poetry can feel very lonely because actually not a lot of people read poetry, sadly. But I'm absolutely convinced that we need fellow pilgrims, we need fellow travellers on the road. We're all in this together. Yes.
Hello.
Where am I looking? Oh, hello, Grace.
Hello.
Hello.
I was thinking as you were talking about journeys and how I really love the ideal of being really, lightly packed, travelling lightly and going out and exploring and, you know, seeing things along the way and journeys as this kind of ideal. But actually, I was just reflecting, actually, my journeys are not always like that because I get a bit admin-y and I pack too much stuff and I get obsessed with, like, antibacterial hand gel. Like,
don't you know we all?
And actually that kind of applies to home as well. There is this ideal and then there's kind of the mundane reality of not having a dishwasher and washing did and the undying middle class angst of washing up or getting a dishwasher. And like, and I wonder how that applies to what you're saying. Like, there is this kind of paraphernalia that is quite ever present but really boring and really bogs us down and yet is quite practical and in that God is what is God? Is God not at all boring? Is he really exciting? He doesn't get bogged down in the paraphernalia. Is he like what is God in that? Is God exciting? Is God down with the pain of that? Is, you know, are there tangents? I'm kind of opening this up to you.
Well, I can't speak for God, sadly, but I think it is. Yeah, it's really easy to over romanticise travelling, isn't it? Charles Foster's book, The Sacred Journey, is brilliant, but it is kind of really annoying and provocative at times as well. I wonder if there's a hint of romance in there. I know that he personally is someone who always needs to be on the move, in maybe almost a kind of compulsive way. But I think, I mean, I don't know, 40 years in the desert, they must have had a hell of a lot of paraphernalia. And it's not like the tabernacle was, you know, a pop-up tent. That involved a lot of religion. I'm sure... Can people stop laughing at me? It's really off-putting. Sorry? They're laughing with me. Okay, brilliant, thanks. What was I saying? I think, there's a lot of paraphernalia and I think it can be really boring and it can be really distressing. And I think that's really what I wanted to pull out in the whole of this talk. Like, it is horrible paradox. We want to make things one thing or the other. Oh, yay, journey, it's so exciting, it's so new. But actually it's, oh, really? Do I have to carry on? Am I really going to be wandering around this desert for 40 years? And even when I get there, you're going to be reminding me? So I think... I don't know. I guess God is in the boring because we've got to believe that he's somehow everywhere in it all. But I don't. We just have to put one step in front of the other, I suppose. And I don't know. Sorry. Yes. Yes. Can I just say yes to everything? Okay. Good. Thanks. Are we done?
Yeah, I think we're done. Thank you for your questions and thank you for your attention. Your blessing?
Yeah, I just wanted to write a little something because, like I said, I was really conscious that this is kind of the last night and we're probably all going to go and do a few more fun things and then head home. And so Psalm 121 was apparently a psalm that was read over pilgrims returning home after they'd been to Jerusalem. So I kind of wanted to just draw from that particular psalm. and read just something very simple that I wrote this afternoon as a blessing to you all for going home from Greenbelt. As you pack up your tent, lift your eyes to the stars. Who is your companion for the journey home? As you leave these fields, look to the hills. Your companion is the one who made them. May the Creator watch over you as you go from here. May he keep you in his gaze as you sleep. May the Redeemer be the shade over your head at midday. May he be the blanket that warms you at night. May the companion keep you safe in the darkness. May he be the one who guides each of your steps. And may the God of tents and camping, of roads and homes, of festivals and quiet places, watch over all your journeying, tonight and always.